Thanks very much. Really enjoying the visit here. It's very nice so far. So I wanted to tell some stories about some projects that I've done coming together in that they involve effects due to substructure.
Can you just turn your microphone on?
Oh, yes. Got that thought. Thank you.
Okay, better. Okay, so so then we're seeing these effects of small-scale structure in indirect detection, and it turns out that this is can be quite important. So I wanted to tell you about it and some of the results that we're starting to come up with and hope to see more of in the future. So I'll talk about a little bit about substructure and some of the very interesting physics that we're probing by observing substructure. And then I'll talk about how we can probe, actually see the substructure. And so, of course, I'll be focusing on indirect detection of annihilating or decaying dark matter. In this talk, I will focus on annihilating dark matter. And then I will talk about some of the different astrophysical ways in that this may be probed and how we can try and extract information. And so a number of works that I'll be taking results from with these collaborators, my current boss, John Beacom, previous boss, Bhaskar Dutta, and some previous postdocs at CCAP where I'm at, Bazadeb Dasgupta, Shinsaku Horiuchi, Koto Murasa, and Carson Rott, and then graduate students Kenny Eng and Ranjan Laha. The large-scale structure of matter is seen to collapse. Sorry, it's a little bit hard to see, but it seemed to collapse in these structures, very similar to almost spherical halos of dark matter. And so in the one sense, you can think of taking something that looks like a cosmic web and just taking the densest regions and those densest regions could be over here with halos, and you can insert as many halos as you need to get an appropriate description so that if I want to calculate an annihilation signal, all I need for these two to give the same signal is that the mean square density to be the same in both of these, and also that the power spectrum would also be the same in these two pictures. And so we have ways, we believe, in order to construct an associated halo model to do this, and therefore be able to theoretically come up with models that would calculate a signal from what we're seeing in simulations in a more tractable way. But also, each of these little dots here, each of these halos, also, in simulations that go to higher and higher resolution, look something like this, with lots and lots of little subhalos here and lots of substructure. And this is a picture from the Via Lactea simulation. Moving on. And so here's another picture from the Aquarius simulations of a Milky Way-sized halo. And again, it seems like, again, you have a smooth distribution with very little substructure in the center, and as you move further out, it becomes you get a lot more of these smaller structures here. And so, a description of a radial distribution of some mass function of subhalos is one way of trying to describe such substructure, and also the profiles of each of these and the substructures within each of those subhalos, and so on. And then we try to get a good description. But the simulations only give us so much information in that the resolution is only so good. So there's always going to be some extrapolation to resolutions beyond the simulation and some effects due to that, such as, well, how small do these structures get? And so presumably, the smallest of these structures were formed early in the universe. And when the first primordial halos formed, and then these collect and larger structures are able to collapse later on in the universe. And this is something interesting to be interesting to observe. What is the scale of smallest structure? And this is determined by properties of the dark matter itself. And so could it be set by a free streaming scale? Or are there some interactions that can generate some acoustic oscillations that would wash out this free streaming scale? And then you're set by some acoustic oscillation scale. So observing this would, and so on, observing this cutoff in the power spectrum would give us some very, very interesting information about the dark matter and about its interactions with other matter, potentially. And of course, the scale actually can result into some different effects for indirect detection signals, which I'll describe. But what other physics? So there's a lot of discussion now of different baryon physics processes that can affect this substructure. So if supernovas and stellar radiation can disrupt or evolve the substructure of dark matter, if also active galactic nuclei in the center, also REM pressure has been thought to be able to strip these subhalos of gas and the ability to form stars, and making them very, very difficult to observe through radiation. This is an example of a simulation from the FIRE project showing a Milky Way-sized halo. This is 200 kiloparsec size. Left is density, right is temperature. And with all the stellar processes and feedback processes going on, there are these huge cold outflows and explosions that cause a lot of this mixing on the scale in the inner part of the galaxy. And so this can cause gravitationally, even just gravitationally, a irreversible effect on the structure of any gravitational object, collisionless or not. And this can then have an effect. Even later on, you can get these very violent outflows. So what are the effects of these? So we're starting to get simulations that are producing stars and so on in a way that look right, even though the physics is very effective. And so we can start to give possible answers to some of these questions. Here's the example of REM pressure stripping. This is from the CLUES project, which is a simulation, a constrained simulation of our local universe, trying to reproduce what our local universe looks like today. And so here's some various local objects, and they start out with it. So here they start in these positions with, get it paused. Okay, and so you start with very smooth and you cause this collapse. And what you see here is actually you get a sheet of matter, and it keeps pausing. And it passes through this red dot, this here, which is the Milky Way. And this ends up causing a big pressure on the material within our galaxy. And so if I go on. Okay, so on the left is dark matter and the gas. And so this is zoomed in again on the Milky Way here. And then here comes that sheet, boom. And it takes a lot of the gas on the right side with it. And so on the left, you see a lot of dark matter structure still there. But on the right, most of them, the smaller ones, have been stripped of the gas. And therefore, they're not going to form stars, and they're not going to be visible. Yet they could still be there. So this is another interesting idea that comes into. And also the stripping as well could have some gravitational effects, irreversible gravitational effects on their structure as well. OK, and so then this continues. And we can see then the formation of the disk, I believe. No disk in this one. But you can see the gas comes back and gravitationally and replenishes the galaxy again, but it's no longer being held by these structures. Okay, and so that's just baryonic physics, but we can go on to other physics of the dark matter itself. And so very light dark matter, such as warm dark matter, dark matter with self-interactions, these dark matter, different kinds of dark matter with different properties, these all affect what can happen in the structure. So again, the CLUES project looked at, so what we're seeing is warm dark matter is indistinguishable from cold dark matter on the larger scales, but you're not able to, it collapses much later and does not form the smaller objects in the early universe. And so, again, being able to see the difference here will give us a lot of very good information. Now, this has been a hot topic at dwarf galaxy scales and trying to understand certain anomalies with dwarf galaxies, but now it's being understood that these don't, it's hard to make these have an effect on the dwarf galaxy scales, but they still have an effect on scales much lower than those. Even beyond general relativity, so modified gravity, F of R gravity, can be weak, and in this blue line, look like general relativity on large scales, but produce excess power on smaller scales. And so, again, this is something that could be interesting, a small-scale structure. So can we observe it? And this has been very difficult. So again, radiation, star formation is not efficient enough. And anything smaller than a dwarf galaxy, it's not thought you could really efficiently produce enough stars to see stars. So these small structures are going to be too small to see with a telescope. Strong gravitational lenses have some hope of being able to observe smaller substructures, smaller than the dwarf galaxy scales, maybe down to 10 to the 6 solar masses. But again, not down to the very, very low solar mass and below. So it could be that indirect detection is actually the most direct way to probe small-scale structure. And so... Yes, so flux ratio anomalies is a perfect example of this. Yes,
and that gets down to about 10 to the 6.
Yeah, so the current simulations show 10 to the 6. I've talked to Chris Kachanik about this. He thinks it could get down to 10 to the 5, but he doesn't believe it could get any better than that. But even there, you need a large sample of lenses in order to come up with a model. You need an ensemble, basically, to have a statistical description. And so we don't have enough statistics to actually do this, but it's probable if you find enough of these that you could do some analysis.
Why is it that Gaia can measure like the very, very small scales? Isn't that a lensing effect? Like my God lensing or something? Or am I thinking
of this? I'm not sure.
What is it that Gaia does to get...
So if you see some unusual stellar motions, that's also another possibility, some interaction of stars with halo substructure. That gets difficult. Maybe Gaia has a chance of doing some physics there.
I think she said Gaia cannot do it.
It can't do it if the dark matter profiles, if the sub-halo profiles are as large as those predicted by CDM. They're denser than CDM.
I see. So very contracted profiles.
It is a lending effect.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so new ideas here would be, there are a lot of interesting things here. So if you have new ideas for being able to observe these substructures, by all means, that'd be excellent. So that motivates what I'm doing here with indirect detection. So let me just review quickly how what contributes to a dark matter signal. And so what I'm looking at is in a particular direction, I see some intensity of gamma rays at some energy. And so what I'm doing is a line of sight integral over the density squared field along that line of sight. And this is weighted by the annihilation spectrum here. And so if there's some annihilation at some redshift z, it needs to be, in order to observe it at redshift e, it had to have been produced at redshift 1 plus z times e. And so if I'm a certain distance below the mass of the dark matter, the mass of the dark matter particle is the highest energy you could possibly see. And so I can only see a certain distance away. So the higher energy photons came from nearby, lower energy ones then are integrated up to that distance away. And so there's some tomography here as you're looking in energy. We're also normalized by 1 over the m squared, which converts the number density squared to the density squared. And then we have the annihilation cross-section, sigma v. So I'm going to consider S-wave annihilation, so I'm not coupling to the velocity distribution, just to simplify this discussion. And so then sigma v is a constant, and it sets the rate of annihilation in a gas of a certain number density. The mass can be determined from the spectrum here, as I said. There's going to be a cutoff in the spectrum at the mass, so you can see the mass from the signal. But if you were to see a signal, the quantity of this normalization here of the cross-section is ambiguous with what the normalization of this density squared is, which is strongly affected by substructure. So there is this ambiguity. So if I were to observe an intensity signal, I wouldn't be able to read the cross-section off unless I know very well what the substructure content is. So that's this ambiguity. Now, for local annihilation, something within our halo, or anything at near redshift zero, this integral reduces to just the line of sight of the density squared. And this is, in the literature, called the J factor. So I'll refer to the J factor here as just this density squared integration. And so again, here, then there's an ambiguity. If I saw a signal within a certain direction of our galaxy, the normalization of the J factor is ambiguous with the normalization of this cross-section. So there's astrophysics versus particle physics ambiguity here. So we need one to understand the other. And so there are ways to break this. So in the case we're talking about where sigma v is constant, so if I look in different regions and I see a different intensity in different regions, then I know what I'm seeing is a change in density. And so the sigma v is constant. So if I know the relative density between two different regions, or the relative density squared, then that's enough to construct all the information. And the other way I would talk about is to look for spatial variations of the signal. So if I'm thinking about galactic center, I don't know precisely what the density profile in the galactic center region is, but if I start to see a variation of intensity with latitude from the galactic center, I can then construct what that is compared to models, and then determine using that with the information we have, then we can determine the right J factor and so on. And then I'll talk about, for extragalactic signals, how we can take advantage of the angular power spectrum, the variation of the on small scales that you see, to try to reconstruct this information. Okay, so in indirect detection, where does small scale structure affect indirect detection? So I talked about the extragalactic, so when I'm looking beyond all the halos outside of our galaxy, all has substructures. So the extragalactic diffuse gamma rays are heavily affected potentially by the substructure. When I'm looking for signals in nearby galaxy clusters like the Virgo cluster, Coma cluster, Fornax cluster, those also are predicted to have lots of substructure. And then also within our galactic halo. So I'm going to consider two scenarios here. One is where the substructure is really causes a big increase in intensity to the signal. There is a lot of substructure, and therefore are responsible for our observation of dark matter. They become the reason for discovering a signal, observing a signal. Then I'll also talk about the case where it is not... any of these regions is not as bright as, say, a galactic center region where it's dense, but there's not a lot of substructure there. And so then what do we learn in that case? So first, when substructure impacts discovery, I'm going to consider the case of looking at a nearby galaxy cluster, particularly the Fornax cluster in the southern hemisphere. And what I'm going to do is take three recently published models of substructure, just for comparison, and see what kind of signals they predict. So one is this Gao et al. Model that is used by this Han et al. Paper. It's based on Phoenix and Aquarius simulations, and it gives a fitting formula for the angular surface intensity of the substructure, so an intensity profile of the surface profile. Then there's this Kamienkowski, Kushiapias, and Kulin model that gives a model for the density probability distribution function. And so from that, we can construct the effect of substructure. They fit their model to V-Lactea 2 simulation. And then we're interested in the galaxy cluster, which is much larger than V-Lactea 2. So there's a scaling that was suggested by Sanchez-Conde et al. That we will apply. And then there's a model by Pinsky, Frommer, and Bergstrom that they used in their analysis of signals from galaxy clusters. And they fit the intensity of substructure to a double power law from their simulations. And they extrapolated down to a minimum subhalo mass of 10 to the minus 6, which is what is done for each of these here. But I'm going to, for an example, scale down to 10 to the minus 12 solar masses, which is about as low a scale as you see in some particle physics models.
So when you say scale down, it's just a power law extrapolation?
It's just a power law extrapolation, that's right. So they have an index that they found, and then they just assume the scaling, right? So it's obviously not taking into account disruptions properly, all those things. So I would consider this to be an overestimate, I'm sure.
So do all of these extrapolate to power law, or is there any of them that doesn't?
The Kamienkowski model is, it's more sophisticated than just a power law, but I'm not sure, actually, I don't recall.
Product of two power laws?
What's that?
I mean, in what sense is it more sophisticated?
Sure.
No, I'm just asking.
I don't recall exactly how it goes.
Because I can't see, doesn't matter, as long as you're simulating things and you're not resolving the stuff that you want, you have to extrapolate one way or another.
That's right, one way or another. So. That's right. So I'll talk about that a little bit more, how we handled that in our other works. So what I want to do is compare the signal from the galaxy cluster with lots of substructure to what we might expect to be a really bright signal in the galactic center, which is a very nearby, very dense source. And so in order to estimate a realistic signal from the galactic center, I took some analyses from two papers, one by Ketna and Ulio, that looked at kinematical data and Maser data, and in order to assume a particular profile. So here you assume an NFW profile, keeping the scale radius and scale density and so on as three parameters, and you best fit those parameters to the data that's available. And they come up with a range here of parameters that fit. And so I would take this as the range of NFW parameters that are consistent with data. And more recently,
so
this was
the Milky Way.
This is for the Milky Way, yes. This was recently redone by Nesty and Salucci, and they came up with very similar results. And so I can take these results. Now, Ketna and Ulio also did this for an ASTO profile, and Nesty and Salucci also did this for a chord profile, a Burkert profile. And so we could see the effect of when it's not as dense as the NFW profile. Okay, so now the scale factor for the Fornax cluster, I determined from X-ray data with a number of assumptions about how relaxed the Fornax cluster halo is. And so getting these results, then I come up with these J factors, just simply J factors. And then these would apply to be scaled by the cross section over mass squared and so on to get the intensity signal. But comparing the J factors then gives you the idea. So the scale of the Fornax cluster is about 3 degrees radius in the sky, 6 degrees diameter. And not much difference between the different profiles except in the centers. Here that I use, but quite a large difference between the different profiles. So the Kamienkowski model is a lot lower than the other two, but these two are fairly consistent. But then again, these are the ones I'm saying did just a power law extrapolation that is likely to be an overestimate. And then if I extrapolate again down further to 10 to the minus 12 solar masses with this P11 model, it comes way up here.
So the Kamenikoski model, you couldn't go to that, I mean?
It's not clear. Yes, there is a way to do it. They don't have M-min specifically in their model, but they have normalized with various parameters. And so you can actually rescale some of these parameters to bring this up. And so I'll show that in a little bit, how that looks. Okay, so now if I compare this to the galactic center models, so the NFW and Anastro profiles were in this range here on these angular scales.
Just a question. Can you explain why this is flat? Why the small and mean J is flat?
So what we have here, it looks like, is a large population of very tiny concentrated halos surviving and living in the center. And why it's flat, it's not clear to me, actually. I don't have a good explanation.
If they follow the density, then and you're projecting it, so the density of NFW is 1 over R, and then if you project it, you integrate over R, so this would be the square, so it would be a flat, because I think I have that explained. If it goes as density as square, then it wouldn't be flat, it would be peaked like this.
Oh, I see, yeah, so because we are going as density.
Right.
From these tiny
and then projecting, then that should.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the point that we want to make here is that it may be possible for a cluster with a great deal of substructure, surviving substructure, to be as bright as or brighter than a chord profile. So if you had, say, AGN activity smoothing out the profile in the center of the Milky Way, then that may not be as bright as, or would be a similar brightness as a galaxy cluster with lots of substructure nearby. And so this is useful for, say, the Ice Cube experiment is on the South Pole looking at the Southern Hemisphere, and it's already doing a galactic center analysis with neutrinos. And so neutrinos is a different messenger than what Fermi is looking at with gamma rays. So depending on the sources, those could be different. And so they're doing a galactic center analysis. And since this is also in the Southern Hemisphere, it would also be the same analysis as a galactic center. So they may want to just apply the same analysis to this different region of the sky. Whereas those in the Northern Hemisphere, it's a different analysis because the Earth vetoes astrophysical muons, so they have a much easier time in doing those analyses. Okay, so now let me move on to this other example where we might discover a signal in, say, the galactic center, but then don't see a signal elsewhere. So now, is that expected, or would that strongly be constraining the kind of substructure that we can actually have? What are those constraints like? And so there, an example is, so this 130 GeV gamma ray line was suggested from the galactic center as an example is a good example where you have a potential signal, and if it is dark matter, then we can make some statements about what that would mean for not having seen such a line in the high galactic latitudes. And so there are some issues with this putative signal. The biggest one is that softer line down here. So the dotted line shows where the data would be without a signal. The softer line shows the best fit signal fit using their PSF. And then if you allow the width of the PSF to change, you get this dark line, the point spread function. You can see that the line is too narrow for their point spread function.
When you say point spread function as energy resolution? Or
yes, in this case, energy resolution, yeah. Exactly. So that suggests some instrumental effect. And in fact, there was seen a similar line in gamma rays coming from the Earth's atmosphere from cosmic rays in the Earth limb, but at a different intensity. So it's not as bright as to explain this feature. So it's likely that there's probably an instrumental effect plus an upward fluctuation. We haven't been getting new photons in this energy, so that suggests there was an upward fluctuation that is now shrinking. So the only strange thing is, with the instrumental effect, is that no line was seen in the other region of interest, But again, if it were just an upward fluctuation on top of the instrumental effect, then that could explain all of that. So that's likely what's going on. But there is another example where there's an extended source from the galactic center that persists some excess. So here's if you actually, when you, what they do is look, take the data from the galactic center region and you subtract the galactic diffuse emission and the isotropic emission that Fermi has modeled from their other data, previous analyses. And then if you also subtract the point sources that are known, and they also see an additional isotropic component in the region of the galactic center, and subtract that as well, you still end up with an excess. Okay, so then take a look at the molecular gas from 20 centimeter line data, and assume that there's some component that follows molecular gas. And also take so that's here MG. And then also consider there's another diffuse component that Fermi is missing that follows a stellar population, and add that as well. And so what's the best fit with those spatial distributions? And you're still left with an excess that you can't explain. There's no possible signal with those spatial distributions that could explain this. Then if you assume, well, let's put in a population of millisecond pulsars. So what's the ideal population of millisecond pulsars? And then see what the excess is. Then the excess goes away. And so then they would need, three to 5,000 typical millisecond pulsars in order to account for this excess. And so here you see, if you just did the molecular gas and not millisecond pulsars, and assume there's no signal, you get a terrible constraint in the cross section in this mass range where they see it. But this would be the signal region. But now if you include a model of millisecond pulsars, then again, there's no visible signal and you get very good constraints, assuming that's what's going on. Okay, so, but if it were dark matter, then what would that tell us about small scale structure? And that's what I wanted to look into. So if we don't see a signal in the isotropic diffuse gamma rays that corresponds to this galactic center, then how does that limit small scale structure? So what we want to do then is to model an extragalactic component. We need the mean density squared at each redshift.
Sorry, I'm not following. Okay. Are you talking about the galactic center or isotropic component?
Okay, so what I'm setting up here is I'll take this putative signal here, and let's take the dark matter interpretation of that. So say, there's no way to verify that unless we start seeing it in other places or something else. But so we'll get to that. But the question is, if we were to verify that this is dark matter, can we learn about small-scale structure from that observation? And so what I'm going to do is now model give a model of small-scale structure in the extragalactic and in the galactic halo. So when I'm looking out in high latitudes away from the Milky Way, and I'm looking at those annihilations. Now, how does that limit the small scale structure? Or is it consistent with not seeing anything? So now I'm going to describe the model of the structure that we used and then the conclusions that we got from that model.
Sorry, so in the 3,000 to 5,000, this is the best 3,000 to 5,000 unresolved pulsars in the whole galaxy.
No. Sorry. So what they did is, I believe it was a 7 degree by 7 degree box where they did this analysis. And so they're looking just in that region. And what they are to compare against is they're looking at the gamma rays that they see from globular clusters. And those gamma rays are certainly from unresolved pulsars. And so they can use that as a guide as to what we expect pulsars to look like. And then apply that to this signal and say then, how many do we expect?
But is there an independent estimate for how many pulsars you would expect in that region? Like, is 3 to 5,000 what you would have expected?
Yeah, there have been a number of papers trying to look at this. there was a paper by Hooper, Siegel, Gaskins, and I forget who else, that concluded that models are not consistent with this being. The distribution just does not fit a millipulsar profile. But they were pretty restricted in the way they modeled as well. And this took the other extreme where we're not going to model anything. We're just going to fit an ideal spectrum. for spectrum, and sure, it can happen, but that may be inconsistent with what we know about population dynamics. But you have to then, the hardest part is we have a sample of observed, and then how biased is that sample? And that's the main question that we don't know. How does our observed data or observed population of pulsars match the overall population? And I think that's the biggest unknown. There have been some new pulsars that were found that have a harder spectrum than what they used. And so if that these harder spectra were to make up more of them, then you would actually need fewer pulsars than this, is my understanding. Yes?
You made the statement, if we verify this is dark matter, what does that mean beyond what you have already?
I'm sorry, to verify
how
dark matter?
How would you verify beyond what you have here that it is dark matter?
How would we verify it is dark matter? So the answer to that really depends on what dark matter is and what the signal is like. So there is no one answer for all scenarios. What I would suggest is that if we see a signal in the galactic center and it's the first signal we see, and then we start to see something from the dwarf galaxies that is consistent, and then we start to see something in the diffuse gamma rays, again, that would be consistent as data gets better and better and statistics get better and better. Then we start to see a larger, consistent picture that would give evidence for this hypothesis. But I mean, even just the existence of dark matter was questioned for decades, and it took. It's still questioned now, and it should be questioned. But there are a huge number of observations that give credence to the hypothesis, and I think that the similar thing would have to happen here with an astrophysical signal. Yeah.
So in other words, this data by itself is not sufficient. You need other independent data from underground experiments.
That's right. Even if it becomes believed that millisecond pulsars could not produce, everything we know about millisecond pulsars just cannot produce this signal, then people can start to think of other possible sources, astrophysical sources, that might account for it. And that this will continue.
So really, this is just motivation, and the idea is it gives you a typical scale that you can plug in and look for to get an idea.
Yes. So what I want is an intuition as to what is the information content in a signal? What can we hope to learn? And I think that's what we gain from these exercises. And this can inform the kinds of analyses that we do and the kinds of experiments that we pursue. Yeah, so absolutely, this is all motivational. Yeah, and helpful for a theoretical intuition. OK, good. So that's our goal. What we are taking is this Kamienkowski Kulin Kushiapis model, and scaling it to different halo masses using the Sanchez-Condi scaling suggestion, and applying that to all the halos, all the field halos. And so if we had just smooth field halos, NFW profiles, you would get this black line. And if you would just apply the Kamienkowski model with the scaling of Sanchez-Condi, you get this blue line. And so not much of an increase in this density squared. But then there are other, actually, let me draw your attention to this light blue dotted line. That's the Gao model being applied to the different masses. And it goes way up like this. And this is the effect of this power law extrapolation all the way down to small scales.
So are you saying that in Kamienkowski's model, there is no boost, basically?
It's a small boost. It's a very small boost. And you can kind of see here what's happening. There's a small region in the outer region of the very largest halos where you're getting a boost.
But here you're not tending a mean, and but there in the other plot you were showing it as a function of mmin and
the. That's right. So then we put in the dependence. So here mmin actually comes in terms of a maximum density parameter, and so there's a relation between this maximum density that you can have for, and that's the upper limit of the densities that you integrate up to in your distribution, density distribution. And so then you can relate that to mmin and therefore get.
But apparently it doesn't make much of a difference.
So not much difference. But there is this, again, this parameter that so where you would get more of an effect in the outer halos. And particularly some of the work you've done where you've seen actually some that we could expect to see more of a boost in the outer halo. And so we can renormalize. So they normalize to Via Láctea 2, but again, you're limited there in terms of how low you're going. So what you can do is you can normalize to a higher scale. And what we did is we fit to the scale model at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses so that they agreed at this scale. And you get something that would extrapolate down to smaller masses more reasonably. And so we call this red line our high substructure model, and this blue line, the low substructure model. And this is something, a technique that has been used in other papers as well in describing the effect of substructure. So this is the description that we try. And this gives actually a coherent picture in that when you look at the concentration distribution that we're using here as opposed to over here, I mean, what you expect is as you have a concentration distribution that's the power law that the simulations resolve, but as you get down to small scales to the primordial halos, well, many of these primordial halos collapsed at nearly the same time, and so they should have nearly the same concentration, because this is pretty much set by the background density at the time you collapse. And so at the lower end, your concentrations should be nearly similar, and so there should be a flattening of this concentration-mass relation. And that's what we are using here in this Prada fit with the model. And so this gives a much better, more physical expected extrapolation. And so if I apply this to galactic halo to our J factor as a function of viewing angle from the center, you have the smooth halo contribution here. And here we showed it for different profiles. So we'll take this NFW1 in the middle. And here's the effect of the substructure. So not much in the middle, as you expect, but more on the outer. And this is for the high substructure model. The low substructure model is down here, and you really don't get much of an effect. But you see more with the high substructure model. Okay, so then we have this dependence. So now the way our model is set up is the signal will depend on this minimum mass scale. And we can see what the effect is on that. Okay, so if I were to look for, say, the gamma ray line, then I'm looking for a bump in the Fermi data. So the green points here are the Fermi published data, and then their best fit power law fit. And then these lighter points are their preliminary data. And so we expect some attenuation of a power law just from interaction with the background light. And that's shown here by this gray line and for one model. But so we're starting to see some of this attenuation effect actually happening finally. And so here, the blue line shows a case of the low dark matter. And you can kind of see in the middle here two bumps. The one on the right is the galactic contribution, and the one on the left is the extragalactic for that model. And then the associated high model goes up here. And then you can see the effect of the bumps on the power law just to guide your eye. And so then you can imagine that we're trying not... We can set a limit based on not overproducing what's been observed.
This looks like it would be very difficult to disentangle the uncertain distribution of the extragalactic background light and the line you have here. Right? You have a line on top of an absorption feature, and both are uncertain.
On top of an absorption feature?
Well, that's what the EVL cutoff.
Right. So what you'd be looking is a rise and then on top of the drop. Yes. So you might end up with a little outward bump. But right, it would have to be large.
You have to convince everyone.
With the current state of things, it would have to be large in order to see it, right? And so that's so the limit is going to be at a place where the bump is large, actually. And so yes, if it's going to be a small bump, you're right. There's just no verifiable way to see it, especially with where the drop is going to be. So we're conservative by you know taking the limit to be where this upper line is approximately, right? So that would cause that point to go up significantly. So okay. So then what we can do then is we would limit what the density squared today as for different minimum masses that we would have seen for different cross sections here. So here's the clumping factor, the astrophysics, and here's the particle physics over here. And this green region is the range of cross sections that was consistent with the line signal when it was published. And so then this is the cut of the line, assuming that the line made up all of the background, the gamma rays at that energy. And so there would have to have been a corresponding absorption in the background at that point as well in order to account for that to be like that. But so this is the most conservative cut that you can make. And so, and then we're showing here the minimum masses associated with each of those. So for the high model and for the low model. And so we're not really cutting into any interesting parameter space here. All the way down to 10 to the minus 12 for this model is allowed. It's consistent with not having seen anything at the 100%. But if you say that, well, we should be able to see if it made up 10% of the IGRB, then that cut, then there, it actually does rule out all reasonable clustering. So minimal clustering means up to the scales that we've seen in observations. And so I think it was 10 to the 8 solar masses. Okay. So then at the highest cross-section, we should have seen that already, is the statement, to 10%. Or we will see it, maybe not with current data, but future data, Fermi should be able to observe that with that kind of substructure modeling. Whereas if you had the high substructure, so substructure is much more, then the limit at the small cross-section end, then you limit the high stress substructure model to a minimum mass of 1 solar mass and the low at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. And so anything stronger than that, we should be able to see. And so we're limiting the scale for two different scenarios here. And then we can make some statements like that. But we have a regime here where it's really quite model independent, that you really should have seen it even if it were just smooth halos or with very, very minimal substructure that we observe, Bohr scale clustering and so on. Okay. So now if we do something similar with the diffuse galactic center signal that was seen that's consistent with millisecond pulsars, it can be described as a 30 GeV dark matter annihilating to BB bar. And that create bumps like these. Here's the low substructure, associated high substructure. And these will go up and down based on the amount of substructure that we have, and also in the cross-section. So this is the parameter space that's allowed. Again, 100% doesn't do any limit, but the 10% doesn't really constrain much for the low substructure case, but it has some interesting constraint to 10 to the minus 6 solar masses for the high substructure case on the low cross-section limit. So. So that's with BB bar. It's also consistent with taus, annihilation to taus for lower mass dark matter. And here, if this were verified to be more consistent, that actually has more severe cuts in the minimum mass for substructure. So it looks like that we should expect to see an associated signal in the diffuse gamma rays. And if not, then we can make some statements about the small scale structure.
It's a little bit hard to follow this. So how many three parameters do we have here? We have the cross-section, we have the clumping factor, and we have the minimum mass.
So the clumping factor and the minimum mass are tied to each other one-to-one with our distribution model.
But that depends on the model, right?
So that's model dependent, yes.
So you have two parameters and the choice of model, which you can think of it as a third parameter.
Sure. Probably more, but that's an investigation that would be important. And this is where theoretical understanding of dark matter clumping becomes important.
So is there any way, but ultimately, okay, so the question, if this excess is due to dark matter annihilation, then you can actually rule it out by looking at the background. If the excess is not due to annihilation, then you cannot say it.
Right. This is a scenario here where you've ruled out all possible scenarios. We didn't see it, say it, so we can rule out. It's not consistent with that line being due to dark matter.
So is this saying if there's the line, there has to be substructure below 10 to the 8 solar masses? Is that what this is? So the minimum dark matter clustering is just saying there's no substructure below 10 to the 8.
Yes.
And you're saying that if that was all there was, then you ruled that out. So there would have to be more in order to explain that. In order to explain the signal, there would have to be substructure below 10 to the 8 solar masses.
In order to explain the signal at the galactic center, you're asking? I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, you're saying assuming there's this line.
Yes.
You're able to make some statements about what n min is.
Yeah, so let me consider this interesting case here. So assuming the line, we see a line, assuming that's verified with more data, see a line. And we want to ask the statement, could that be produced by dark matter with a cross-section of 2 times 10 to the minus 27 centimeter cubed per second? And this analysis is showing that there should be a signal in the isotropic diffuse gamma rays. If it is dark matter. For the clustering that we've observed and simulated in that range. So this covers anything below here is probed by observations and simulations. So we know that's there. Therefore, the signal would have to be there, should be there, if our understanding is correct.
The signal would have to be there regardless of what the substructure is doing.
Right.
Because it should be there even in the minimum amount of the substructure.
That's right.
Okay.
If we don't see it, then there's an inconsistency. Either we know that the cross-section for here is too high, it'd have to be something lower, or it's not consistent with it being a dark matter signal.
Okay.
Something like that. Okay, so the point is then it is possible. We're hitting interesting parameter spaces where interesting statements can be made. And the robustness of those needs to be studied with further substructure modeling. Absolutely. Okay, so with a little bit of time left, let me try and breeze through this complementary approach by looking at gamma ray anisotropies. And this is, again, a very interesting way of characterizing a signal, even discovering a signal, and gaining information about it. And so here what we're looking for are angular variations in the sky of a particular signal. And so, again, think about that. If the cross-section is the same, it's a constant, it's the same everywhere, then when we see variations of a signal, you're just looking at the astrophysics. That's just density. So now we gain information about the density variation, and that's substructure, probably. This is what Fermi-LET is looking at. We have all these diffuse foregrounds, and so in their published analysis, they block out the galactic disk and point sources, and then we still had these large-scale emissions peeking through, and so they cut out everything below multiple of 150, and then they don't see any effect of any foreground subtraction at angular scales corresponding to a multiple above 150, and they can their PSF allows them to extend up to 500, LO 500, and so they look at this range and look for an angular power spectrum. And so you can expand in multiples the intensity, absolute variations, and you can also expand these relative variations in intensity. And so the relative, this is very interesting, called the fluctuation angular power spectrum. And so the fluctuation, anything with the fluctuation power spectrum with the relative deviations, I put a little twiddle on. And this quantity for an S-wave annihilation signal is independent of any particle physics. It only depends on the dark matter distribution. So this is an intrinsic quantity for any S-wave annihilation signal. Right. And it's related to this quantity here by intensity squared. So I had this normalization of intensity. So you get from one to the other just by a factor of intensity squared. So some of the properties of this that are important is that if I were to measure the anisotropy of a purely isotropic source, and so I'm receiving gamma rays from this isotropic source, and after I have my data of gamma rays and I calculate an angular power spectrum, it's not going to be quite perfectly flat because of the experiment. And so what you measure is called shot noise, and the more data you receive, the smaller it gets, and it actually goes approximately with 1/1 the number of photons you've received. So this component is subtracted off from the measurement to get at the signal. When I have different sources, components, the intensity power spectrum, you just add up the different components. There are correlation terms between the components. So what I'm talking about is a situation where I'm going to have an unresolved extragalactic contribution of point sources as a background, producing angular power, and a foreground dark matter substructure. And so there is not going to be any spatial correlation between these two components, and so I won't include these correlation terms. For the fluctuation power spectrum, remember you had to normalize by intensity squared, and so each of these terms gets normalized by their fraction of the contribution, the fraction of the flux they contribute squared. So the interesting thing is if I have some background contribution, so Fermi measures, you see here, this is the Fermi measurement of the fluctuation angular power, averaged over from 150 to 500, these multipoles, they do it in 4 energy bins, and these are the energy bins here, and it's consistent with, they're getting a non-zero value, and it's consistent with the constant value. And so we're in a situation here where we can model a constant background, but then add some dark matter contribution at some higher energy, maybe, say due to a line or something like that, and see what our sensitivity to that is. So if I want to talk about sensitivity, we need to understand these error bars here, the statistical error bars. And so there are 2 terms to the statistical error. One is proportional to the measured value of the angular power, and that's a constant. And the other is proportional to the shot noise, and that's decreasing, like 1/n. And so when all of the multipoles in my average are dominated by the shot noise term, then my error is shot noise dominated, and it's shrinking like 1/n. Eventually, when I've received enough photons so that all of these are what I call statistically saturated, they're now a constant statistical error, then you have a constant here. So because the gamma ray experiment at these high energies, the number of photons being received is small, I'll show that we're actually shot noise dominated for the whole experiment. So this is the error that we're considering here. And okay, so we want to know the contribution from dark matter, and so I'll take from this paper here, this is a model of, or a calculation of the angular power spectrum, fluctuation power spectrum, from the Aquarius simulation. And so when I take this and I do the average over from 150 to 500, I get a value of about 0.03 steradians. And you compare it to the measured value here, which is best fit 7 × 10⁻⁶ steradians. So there's 4 orders of magnitude difference between the potential signal and what's actually measured. These are the extragalactic contributions. So in order for them to play a role, there's, again, 4 orders of magnitude difference here. So this would have to be 100 times brighter than this in order to contribute. So the extragalactic will ignore, but here's the substructure intensity. This is a low substructure boost and a high substructure boost. So the low would not contribute. The high in this model would contribute, have an extra galactic contribution. So interestingly, small scale structure can actually dominate the angular power spectrum. So here, this is again from the Aquarius simulation, but this is for the lower, the upper range of their, the masses of their substructure. And if you were to include the lower range of masses that are resolved, that's up here in the dashed line, but you can't see it because the total is covering it up. And so we're completely dominated by the lower substructure. And so really these unresolved substructures could be really, really important here.
So these are substructures within Milky Way, right?
Yes, so Aquarius is like a simulation of the Milky Way, and so this is like, yes.
So the substructure in other halos?
So the ones outside, I was saying these are extragalactic halos and their substructure, and so they may play a role depending on how bright they are relative.
So that was included? So they do have some structure in it, the so, extragalactic ones?
No, so here it's just the galactic. But in the previous figure, sorry, in this figure, this is the galactic substructure,
right.
The fluctuation power, and this is different models of the extragalactic, high and low substructure and so on.
Okay, I see.
But note, this is just the resolved substructure. They didn't extrapolate to lower.
Oh, okay.
And so there is uncertainty there. And we can see the effect of this uncertainty. So if you were to extrapolate further, this is going to need modeling. Okay. So we're probably not going to get the answer from simulations.
I guess I'm a bit surprised because, of course, there are many more subhalos outside Milky Way than there are inside. So you would think they would be
Yes, but they're going to contribute. They're very far away. They're going to contribute at a much smaller angular scale. And so probably much smaller than the angular scales that we're probing here with these at these multiples. So you could see, you can imagine that, sorry, again. This will fall over eventually.
That's the shotguns that dominates the construction term. Individual game.
No, but no, I don't think this shotgun is for, I mean, that shotgun is just the number of, I mean, the reason that's just a line is just because you have lots of satellites that are correlated. That's what happens, right? I mean, the next figure you have.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what why is it a line? I mean, I think it's just like random points or random distribution.
The line here,
yeah.
Actually, this is because they're extrapolating to, what they did extrapolate was actually the profile of these things. And so each of these has a cusp with an iNestor profile.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually, this is the cusp effect here is what you're saying. Here they actually included a core and it caused a turnover.
Right.
So there is this small scale effect at the center of the halos that's important.
Wow, I think that's just an LS squared. So is it not just an LS squared? Which is just shotguns. I don't think the same shotgun.
I think it does go slightly below Poissonian here. They show it goes slightly below Poissonian here.
Okay.
So I think at some point it will turn over, but
let me finish basically.
Okay, good. All right, so here's the picture we had before. And so here's what that picture would look like in angular power. So here's the model for the substructure fluctuation angular power. We don't really know what it is. It's probably going to be a free parameter that we can try to extract from the data. That's information about substructure. So these are the measurements, and this is the best fit from the Fermi data. And here's the Fermi line here. This is for the low substructure model, for the high substructure model. Okay, so we could be very, very sensitive to it, but how sensitive? I make some statements about the sensitivity here, like a signal flux will go like 1 over root n, but our sensitivity to the line in the angular power spectrum goes with this, the uncertainty of this over the substructure here. So in order to be more sensitive in the angular power spectrum than we were in the flux power spectrum, so here you can imagine that we would have discovered this line first in the angular power spectrum before this one became invisible. So in order, what we find with the simple analysis is that if you're wanting to be more sensitive in the angular power spectrum, then the fluxes, the ratio of the flux between them, have to satisfy this. So you're more, this is proportional to the beam width of the experiment. So the angular resolution, better angular resolution, gives you better results with the angular power spectrum. And also you want a high value of this angular power spectrum. So lots of variation in the signal. So I make some comment that the angular power measurement of the line goes like t, proportional to time instead of the square root of time because of what we talked about here. And so something like Fermi LAT, you would actually probably see it first in the flux, expect to see it first in the flux, but then later on it would grow much more quickly in the angular power. It would just appear, and then that would be where you could say we found the discovery. Then we looked at gamma 400 that has a much higher angular resolution. It's not clear exactly why such a high angular resolution would make this so much stronger. So we're going to investigate, but this motivates perhaps that this formalism needs to be better understood and needs to be updated. This is probably not quite correct at these low halo counts. Okay, so it's important to understand that it's not like going like t forever. If I were to extend this for time, you do get this saturation eventually, and so that's a very important point. You don't actually have an astrophysical signal that grows like t forever, and that's important. But in this case, it's one that grows for longer than the lifetime of the experiment, so it's essentially forever. And so when I want to do a complementary search and see what regions of this power space, so here B sub is an intensity boost to the intensity, it's a factor to the intensity. If I calculated what the intensity would be in the unmasked sky of just the smooth halo without any substructure, and I calculate that intensity. Now I add substructure and that increased some factor, and I call that factor B sub. And so B sub equal to 1 means just a smooth halo, no substructure. And so I'll keep that as a free parameter, which says how bright the substructure is relative to the smooth, and then the fluctuation angular power spectrum. And these are the parameter spaces that would give a 2 sigma bump statistically, a 2 sigma height of that line after 1 year and after 5 years. So in 1 year, there is a region of space here. The intensity measurement only restricts the substructure boost, but the angular power spectrum gives this region where it has more sensitivity at higher C sub. And so there is, you can see some region where if we're high enough C sub, remember 0.03 was where we were seeing, then you can see some interesting effect there first. And then similar for gamma 400. And then at 5 sigma, these all move to the right, but this is where it becomes really, really strong for the anisotropy signal. But I would warn that the photon counts here are very low, probably too low in order to see such a confident signal. It's hard to imagine creating an angular power spectrum measurement with high significance with less than, say, 10 photons. But that needs to be understood. So what's the right answer, or is there a reason why you can do that? So that's being studied. So the story is that substructure is really interesting. It depends on a lot of very, very interesting standard and non-standard physics that are not well understood at this point. So constraints on substructure are going to require discovery of annihilation radiation, and that is going to depend on how we discovered it. So it's going to be, so I gave a couple of scenarios, and there are more. Intensity tells us about how dark matter clumps, this clumping factor, density squared. But anisotropy gives us independent information on galactic substructure. And this is complementary to the intensity searches that are going on. So something that should be developed for future searches. Okay, thanks. Yes.
Getting back to your calculations of two photon decay, 10 plus 1 minus 1 drop.
Oh, which one? The
decays into the bar of 10 plus 1 minus 2 photon.
Okay, so here's BB bar.
This calculation has to be very important. If you look at LHC, you have to know whether the particle that's decaying is a mixture of composite, for example, maybe coconium calculations of decay. You need to know the strong coupling constant.
Yes, so,
and so forth and so on.
So those give you the value of the cross section, the branching fractions to the various contributions. And that's right. So the values of those parameters are very particle physics dependent. And so that's, I would say.
You don't know anything about the dark matter.
What? I agree.
Or whether it's composite. What forces are between them?
I agree. All the annihilation signal cares about is what the annihilation cross-section is, what's the value for that, what's the spectrum of whatever you're looking at, gamma rays in this case, what the spectrum of gamma rays produced per annihilation is, and what the mass of the particle is. And that's all we need. So how those are determined from particle physics remains an open question. And so that's why any value for those parameters is allowed, and therefore we can, treat them as free parameters, even though they are highly related to one another. Yes.
You need a particle physics of dark matter particles.
I agree. I agree. So what we're going to do is see radiation and tell you your particle physics has to give these ingredients, and then that can that can constrain the models.
That affects the how many sigma, the confidence of the line that you require, right? I mean, if you have no idea where the line should be, that doesn't mean you can't find it. It just means it has to be a 5 or 6 sigma feature in order to know that it's real.
Absolutely.
If you knew where to look, then you could get away with something that drastically affects your statistics. That's it.
So when you're thinking about how to get these detections with anisotropies and things, there's loads and loads of parameters, and it was quite confusing to me. But it seems like you could simplify this quite a lot, just by analogy to the CMB, by doing a Fisher matrix analysis. Have you thought about that? So you just say, okay, here is, because you've got all these different parameters, but if you just plot, this is the matrix of my detection sensitivity for 3 different foundation models. It's really easy to see that you've just got a matrix of error ellipses and likelihoods. And rather than all these things, I vary this, I vary that, I do this, I do that, just take a Fisher matrix.
That's exactly what we want to do. So the question is, we have all these parameters that for these different signals, and our results depend a lot on the values of these parameters, and we're asking what is the information that we can extract, and so why not do a Fisher matrix analysis? And absolutely, now that we're identifying the fundamental parameters that contribute to these signals, then one can start to answer those questions and start to understand.
And you can also look for how to do things better. So sky cut on this thing looked like a very severe sky cut, he just said this is a rectangle, right? But you could get a lot better, you could increase your f-sky a lot if you did something better. You won't say, is that worth it?
So the sky cut
get that very easily from the fish
depends very much on the foregrounds more than on the aspects of the signal. And
but they're also in the Fisher matrix.
They will also be in the Fisher matrix, yeah, that's
okay.
Sure.
If you're in the Fisher matrix, if you're confident that you can model all the foregrounds in the galaxy, and the answer is nobody's confident that they can model that.
That's a good point.
But you can put a model in for them and say, how well do I need to do to improve this at this level?
So,
So
we have a model that can handle all the possibilities and lots of parameters, and then it becomes difficult. I think we're interested in, imagining we understand the foregrounds a lot better down the future. Someone else is going to figure that out. What is the potential here? What can we learn? And I think what we want to do is really motivate what we're working on, what we want to develop, what experiments do we want to do or see in order to make progress. And I think those are the driving questions.
Yeah.
why on CMD scales can you do so much more sort of sophisticated sky cuts? Is that they just understand the foregrounds that much better?
The foregrounds in CMD are easy.
I don't think they're very sophisticated. Yeah. I mean, there are like so many versions of them, and they.
I just mean that is right. They don't just cut it off at some line.
It's not just a rectangle.
So, keep in mind that
just because the line is curved doesn't mean it's more sophisticated.
Keep in mind this was done very early in the experiment. This was included 22 months of data, but I think the techniques were being developed like from day one, and they had to decide early on how they're going to do this, and then second round will be much better. So this is the first round. It took many years to get it through, and we're still waiting for second round where they are improving on all these things. So they'll use templates and that have been developed since then, and so on. So we can expect more next round, I think.
Okay, I think we should end it there. But before we thank Sheldon again, there will be dinner in Bistro at 6, as usual. Chris Lang's students covered them. With dinner with Sheldon at 6, and I guess we'll all go for lunch as well. So, thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you.